Gordon Hayden.
Now, it's been 10 years since the release of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. It is the indie movie most fans wish never existed. Andy McCarroll joins me now to take a look back at the unmitigated mess that it is and what Spielberg needs to do with the fifth installment to end Indiana Jones on a high. Andy, there's so much we can talk about with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, most of it obviously not being very flattering, like from bad CGI to Shia LaBeouf to aliens. Where do you want to start, Andy?
But probably the very first scene, I think, kind of set the tone where, you know, Indiana Jones, you know, the nuke the fridge scene, that just, like, Indiana Jones has always been kind of, like, it's a fantasy adventure, obviously, but it's kind of grounded somewhat in reality. It was one of those, you know, the few action stars that you'd see, like, you know, when we saw Stallone and Schwarzenegger, they were like these invincible mountains, whereas, you know, Indiana Jones got punched in the face, he'd fall down, he'd get up, he'd be bruised. That was part of the appeal. Like, he wasn't superhuman, and, you know, surviving a nuclear blast by lying in a fridge that gets thrown for 15 miles is ridiculous. It doesn't suit the character, so straight away the kind of the tone of it was terrible. It's also known for, like, the Indiana Jones has these amazing stunts. Like, I think back to Last Crusade with the tank when he's holding onto the edge with by the whip, and it's all done with, like, practical effects and stuntmen. I thought this one relied too much on CGI, and it's very easy to kind of see where those scenes are. Like you mentioned before, the CGI scenes with the swinging monkeys in the jungle, it just completely takes you out of the film and kind of ruins the experience for you.
Yeah, it felt for me that Spielberg just didn't have the creative control he wanted with this installment of Indiana Jones. It was almost like George Lucas was too heavily invested in it because it just reeks of George Lucas, this film. And granted, it's always been a partnership with him and Steven Spielberg, but you really felt that George, if you pardon the pun on this, was cracking the whip. And because there's things in it that you go, well, that's clearly George Lucas has strong-armed Spielberg to get in, like the aliens, like the over-usage of CGI. There was two men really fighting with each other on this film. Like, I don't know if you picked up on anything like that, Andy.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I don't know if you heard, there's actually a recording from way back before Indiana Jones was being pitched, and it's George Lucas and Steven Spielberg kind of creating the character. And like you said, it's George Lucas kind of pitching these, like, in fairness, he's coming up with some good ideas as well, but he's saying things like aliens, and you can hear Steven Spielberg kind of steer them in the other direction, like, oh, we'll go practical with this, maybe he's not this Superman. And, you know, it very much that character was a collaborative process, and I 100% agree with you. I think this was kind of George Lucas allowed to run a bit too free. Spielberg, you know, was shooting, I think it was War of the Worlds as well at the time, so maybe he was a bit distracted by that and didn't have, you know, wasn't able to give the attention to Crystal Skull that was needed.
Yeah, very true, Andy. Just before we speak about what Spielberg needs to do now that El Georgie Porgy is on the sidelines, because there is a fifth installment and it will start shooting next year. But before we have a chat about it, here's just a clip from Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
There may be hundreds of skulls at Akator. Whoever finds them will control the greatest natural force the world has ever known. Power over the mind of men.
Be careful. You might get exactly what you wish for.
I usually do.
A clip there of Cate Blanchett in action as the villain in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Bit of a forgettable villain, which is unfortunate, bearing in mind Cate Blanchett is such an amazing actress. So the new Indiana Jones, Andy, by all accounts, the last featuring Harrison Ford. And when I say featuring Harrison Ford, because you know now that Disney own Indiana Jones, they're going to try and milk this series for what they're worth. What do we know about it? Do we have any idea of a storyline? Anything that has been said behind the scenes about this new one?
No, kind of all we know is that it's going to start shooting April next year and will be released in July of 2020. And like you said, this is going to be the last of the Harrison Ford films, and Bob Iger, the head of Disney, said they see it very much as kind of like The Force Awakens, where this is going to be like a tribute to the indie films, but moving on to a new series. I think that's a huge mistake. I don't think it's like the Indiana Jones is set in, like, it's the real world. It's set in, you know, our universe. It's not like Star Wars, where you have all these, you know, different planets, different characters and spin-offs that you can have. Like, there's nobody in Indiana Jones. You can say, well, I'd love to see a Henry Jones spin-off, or, a Marion Ravenwood spin-off. It's not full of characters. All the characters kind of revolve around Indiana Jones. It's his world, and they're kind of just living in it. So I'm kind of apprehensive that kind of a shared universe of Indiana Jones is the way to be going with it.
That's very true, Andy. It's like James Bond. That would be another example. You don't see any James Bond spin-offs because, you know, there's no other character. He is front and centre. He is the nucleus of those stories. Like, you know, they were trying something with the Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, setting up Shia LaBeouf. But sure, when he fell foul of Spielberg and co, what he had to say about that fourth Indiana Jones movie, he got kicked to the curb. Any ideas, though, Andy, what the fifth film might even be about?
Nothing, but to be honest, I'd love to see. There's a couple of great stories. There was an old computer game called Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis. Like, we've seen Indiana Jones on land, we've seen him on in the air. I'd kind of like to see an underwater search for the city of Atlantis. There's also a spin-off book as well, where he's looking for the knife of Cain. If you're familiar with the story in the Bible of Cain and Abel, it was like the first murder, and the knife that killed him is supposed to have these kind of mythological powers. And I think that would be an interesting thing. I think Indiana Jones works best when it's, you know, he's searching for the idol, the Holy Grail, some sort of mysticism to it. I think Crystal Skull went too far bonkers the other way. We have aliens and skulls, and it's actually the real power was knowledge that's inside of us all along. And I think if you kind of just make a straightforward, you know, here's what he needs to do, here's where he needs to go, and you have the characters around him. Yes. I think again, it's going to go back to setting up to this, you know, whatever it's going to go next. And I think they showed with the last one, it relied too heavily on all these little, you know, nods to previous films. Indiana Jones is, you think, hit the nail on the head there. It's like James Bond. You can watch Raiders, you can watch Temple of Doom, or you can watch Last Crusade in any order. It's not going to affect it. They're very much standalone films, and I think that's how they should stay, to be honest.
Very true, Andy. And, you know, just finally funny, I think the only way they can continue this, because, you know, Harrison Ford is so synonymous with Indiana Jones, so for anyone to take over and that character, you have to do like a young Indiana Jones, obviously, because, you know, Harrison Ford's what, in his late 70s. So where you could bookend it would be Indiana Jones nearly looking back on his life.
But you've done that already with the series, The Young Indiana Jones, and even the Last Crusade. Like, the first 50 minutes of The Last Crusade shows his origin story. You show him getting the hatch, you show him getting the scar. Like, that's kind of all the Indiana Jones origin story you need. The whole thing's covered in the first 10, 15 minutes of Last Crusade.
God bless your memory there, Andy. Fair play to you. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, that's that idea at the window. That's pretty much that's that.
I've dismissed it.
If Spielberg and that are listening. Andy McCarroll, thank you so much. Andy's going to be back a little later on with the movie news, and he'll be counting down We Love Movies' top 5 serial killer flicks.
We Love Movies with Gordon Hayden.
Now on the show, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom is out in cinemas next weekend, and our Serena Bellissimo recently spoke to the film stars Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard about following up the 2015 mega hit. Before we hear from them, here's a clip from the film.
Do you remember the first time you saw a dinosaur? First time you see them, it's like a miracle. You read about them in books, you see the bones in museums, but you don't really believe it. They're like myths. And then you see the first one alive.
This is not your fault.
But it is.
No. This one's on me. I showed him the way.
Chris and Bryce, so great to meet you two.
Likewise.
You have been in your own filmmaking bubble for so long, making Jurassic World. What's it like to actually get out of it, travel the world, and hand this film over to your fans?
It's exciting, and it's also, like, it gives me, like, anxiety a little bit. It's, you know what it is? We're so deeply invested in this franchise and in the legacy of Jurassic Park, because of the impact that movie had on both of us as kids. And so, you know, we just like so badly want everyone to love this ride, you know, love this adventure. So, and we're excited, yeah. and we're desperate as well, you know.
Well, but it is no matter what, it is a bit of relief knowing that, like, hey, at this point we worked our butts off for a long time, and that part is over. Now what we get to do is just go share it with people. And that's, I think that's true. Like a really gratifying thing, because we're seeing that people are really enjoying it. And, you know, that's why we do it. We do it because the fans love it, and we get to do what we do because of the fans. So we're grateful.
There's a scene in the film where Claire is on top of a dinosaur.
Yes.
And Owen turns around and says, "Good job. You're making this look totally normal." Being on set, getting to do what you guys do, That's your normal. But do you ever sit back and go, what are we actually doing?
All the time. Constantly.
Right.
It's ridiculous. Like, there are so many ridiculous little things that we end up doing for our job.
Yeah.
Absurd.
Those moments really happen when I'm with people that I grew up with. Like, if I'm talking to my brother or my sister or any of my friends that I grew up with. It's nice because when you're on set, you're just so focused on doing what you're doing. You have that circle of people, and inside of that circle is people that don't see it as being anything more than a job. And then I go and I hang out with my friends from growing up and my family and stuff, and there's that circle of people, all of whom do think that it's a very strange thing. When those two circles, when you have like the Venn diagram and those two worlds collide, it can feel very awkward because you know that what you're doing is really special and amazing and you're very lucky, but at the same time, you don't want to act like that when you're on set because you don't want people to think that you shouldn't be there. You know what I mean? So it's like it's a strange combination, but for the most part, it's like, wow, what do we get to do for a living? It's unreal.
I've been following your journeys on this press tour. And one thing I hate most, I love traveling, but one thing I hate most is packing. And Chris, you've said that you've got 31 outfits that you have to pack.
Yes.
How do you do that? And how do you guys make that strict baggage allowance that airlines have? You can't possibly.
I ended up paying $600 on my flight from New York to Madrid for my luggage.
For your excess.
Yeah, because I had five suitcases.
Wow.
I was like, I really hope this movie does well because this is a lot of money for luggage. Like,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, crazy, because there's like 50-something outfits.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Fans?
It's the hardest part. It's the packing and the unpacking is, you can't escape it. You got to do it. No one else is doing it for you. The packing and the unpacking is it's like our workout, right?
Yeah. That's the real work.
That's the real work.
Fans from around the world have been camping out to meet you guys. Who did you do that for, or who would you do that for?
Who would I camp out to meet? Oh, man, good question.
You would do it for sports.
I'd do it for sports fans, yeah. I would camp outside to meet the Seattle Seahawks. I'd camp out to meet, like, a UFC fighter. Mm-hmm. I really like that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How about you?
I would probably...
Probably, like, anyone who's,
they're,
like...
They're, like, some authors and some speakers
say,
and, like,
yeah,
TED Talk
people. Yeah,
I'd for sure...
Yeah.
I'd go to extreme measures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you a Tony Robbins fan?
Yeah.
Would you camp out to meet Tony Robbins?
Would I camp out to meet Tony Robbins? No. No, I wouldn't. Because I know that I could just sign up for a seminar and... Yeah.
That's right. Oh, yeah, good point. Right.
Well, guys, this has been really cool meeting you. Thank you so much for the entertainment.
You too.
We Love Movies with Gordon Hayden.
Now, when We Love Movies, it is the movie news time. And joining me, as always, is Andy McCarroll. Andy, we need to talk about Solo, A Star Wars Story first, because it didn't set the box office alight at all like they were intending to. I think they were expecting something like 150-odd million, and it just about cranked out over its four-day weekend in the States, 101 million, and didn't fare well in China. Well, mind you, the Chinese don't really seem to be that taken with Star Wars. And then in Europe as well, it kind of just spluttered along. So it hasn't been great. Ron Howard has been putting a brave face in it. Do you think that Lucasfilm are really going to have to start rethinking their slate, or their future slate of films?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of issues that they have, but I think number one is the cast, and I think you've got like such an iconic role in Han Solo that's associated with Harrison Ford. Like, I think audience kind of showed with the Indiana Jones film, they don't want that role recast. And I know you said there, 100 million sounds like a lot of money. Just for kind of context, that's less than half of what Rogue One took. And Han Solo, which you kind of think of, you know, well, Han Solo is a spin-off film. Maybe it's 100 million is not bad. Han Solo cost, cost $240 million to make, which is the most expensive Star Wars film of all time. So this wasn't like a little kind of Deadpool, we'll throw a couple of million at it and everything is profit. This was, by and large, a massive disaster.
And sure, of course, Andy, they were already through a large portion of the film before Ron Howard was essentially parachuted in to fix the problems and then start reshooting a large section of the film as well. Because, Andy, there's been talk behind the scenes with Lucasfilm that they're going to make this Boba Fett story as well. It's going to be another standalone along with an Obi-Wan story that would take place, a lot is speculated, before Episode 4, when he was living as a hermit on Tatooine. A lot of speculation conversation around that, Stephen Daldry, the director behind Billy Elliot, his name was mentioned as the director for it. Like, these films could be potentially out the window now, Andy, off the back of the lackluster performance of Solo.
Yeah, it seems like Kathleen Kennedy is kind of frantically reshuffling that now. They announced just as Solo was released that James Mangold, who directed 3:10 to Yuma and Copland, was going to be directing the Boba Fett spin-off. I think that potentially could kind of steady the ship. Like, I don't think people have the, you know, he's this cult character, and I don't think people have the affiliation to him or the association that they'd have with Harrison Ford as they did with Han Solo, as they would with Boba Fett. He was kind of seen briefly as a child in Attack of the Clones, which no one has any kind of reverence for that film. So I think that could be the one to kind of course correct it and open up like a new side of the mythology that we haven't seen. We haven't seen, you know, a bad guy Star Wars film, which I think might be an interesting take on it.
Absolutely, Andy. I'd echo that too. Here's my thoughts on Solo, A Star Wars Story, just before we move on. Not to give a review, but why it didn't do well. I think one was the release date. I think a lot of people now have become accustomed to a Star Wars film in December, and bearing in mind that The Last Jedi, even though I enjoyed it, and I know an awful lot of people did, there was an awful lot that didn't. It was a very divisive film, and I think a Star Wars film that came out soon after that, I think just people's patience were a little bit tested. And also, like Solo, I know you loved it. I wasn't that mad about it. I just still feel it's an unnecessary Star Wars movie, and I think a lot of Star Wars fans feel that too. It's almost like, we know what you're at here. This really is just an exercise in making money. Like, granted, I know they all are, but this one just felt a little bit more on the cynical side. So that's my take on it, Andy, anyway, with Solo, A Star Wars Film. But for Star Wars Story, I should say. But Andy, we need to move on, because Ron Howard, he's been talking up a potential Willow sequel. Who needs to see Willow 2?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think people who are counting the money for Solo, A Star Wars Story, will be saying, yeah, I don't think we need this either. If we can't, you know, if we can't make money out of one of the most popular characters of the biggest franchise of all time, who's going to remember, you know, something from 20-odd years ago? It's one of them films that you kind of, you have a nostalgia for because you've seen it as a child. You remember, oh, yeah, Willow, I like that. But to be honest, when was the last time you put Willow in yours? I was a DVD player showing my age again. Like, it's not something you'd revisit very often. And I think, you know, the story apparently is going to focus on the child being grown up. You've Warwick Davis now, you've Val Kilmer. Like, I don't particularly want to see, you know, a 20-year-old Val Kilmer with all the kind of baggage that comes with him and his newly reconstructed face freaking me out. So no. I honestly can't see it being made, but, you know, if it does, I can't see it doing too well.
No, I think the thing is, Willow was made by George Lucas because he could not get the rights to Lord of the Rings, so he wanted to do his own version. And I'd say even if you went back and revisited Willow, I have a feeling it probably wouldn't hold up very well, especially in terms of the effects. I even remember as a kid going, it looks a bit ropey. So I can't imagine a good few years on how they would look. But let's just hope that is just Ron Howard, just a bit of idle chat. Now, something that has been confirmed, Andy, that a lot of, we all kind of felt it would be sooner rather than later, because Danny Boyle did mention that he's heavily involved in Bond 25, that John Hodge, his Trainspotting screenwriter, was dabbling away at a script. But this now all seems like the planets are aligning, that it definitely looks like Danny Boyle is set to helm.
Yeah, it's finally been confirmed that he's directing the film. And I think to give myself a cheap plug there, I interviewed Benedict Cumberbatch recently for Infinity War, and his poker face was awful when I asked him about Bond. So I think, you know, he's definitely going to be involved in it as well if I was to put money on it. It's interesting that Danny Boyle, you know, they've kind of gone with these big name directors recently with Sam Mendes and Martin Campbell for the reboot. I'm very interested to see what his take on it. He, of course, he'd done that little skit in the Olympics with Daniel Craig and the Queen and parachuting in. I think it's going to be more kind of back to the Roger Moore Bond, kind of the fun and the gadgets. I think that's very much the Bonds he grew up with. And I think that's what he's going to put his touch on. Like, I can't see it being, you know, a dark Scottish Bond, you know, hooked on heroin or anything like that. But I'm very, very excited for Danny Boyle to see what he can do with that.
I think Bond needs a bit of a shake-up, believe it or not. I think after Spectre, it didn't really do it for me. It was a bit of a mess, and which is disappointing, bearing in mind Sam Mendes helped reboot Daniel Craig's Bond with Skyfall after the lackluster Quantum of Solace, which I know you love, Andy, which I still find an absolute stinking turd.
I do, and to be honest, I'd kind of like to see a fresh start. Like, I like Daniel Craig as Bond, but I'd like to see Danny Boyle come in and have a new James Bond as well, and kind of start, like, the Spectre kind of ended with the end of Daniel Craig's run as Bond. And I think you know, kind of shoehorning him back into it now feels like a mistake.
It does. I feel, yeah, it feels like they should be handing it on now to someone else, really. But maybe that the right bond just isn't there in the wings. And they've done that with Roger Moore. Sure, they brought him back for A View to a Kill when the man was like 54 or something like that. He was ridiculous. But they didn't have anyone there that they could anoint as the new Bond. Anyway, Andy, just very, very briefly, just on the sequel front, Stephen King's sequel to The Shining, Dr. Sleep, is going to go into production.
Yeah, Mike Flanagan, who recently done the Gerald's Game, the Stephen King film on Netflix, is taking over. Now, the Dr. Sleep is the sequel to The Shining, and it stars an adult, Danny Torrance, as he's trying to kind of come to terms with the aftermath of what happened at the Overlook Hotel. He's got kind of alcoholism and anger issues, and he's able to have a connection with this 12-year-old girl who's being hunted by another kind of a tribe of psychic vampires. And apparently the book is very good to terrible, depending on who you ask. So it's interesting. And again, it's one of these films that, is there a demand for a Shining sequel? You're going to be up against, you know that's constantly in the top 10 anyway, discussions of best horror film of time. And unless you absolutely nail it, you're going to face a backlash, as we've seen, the likes of Blade Runner in recent years as well.
Yeah, I don't know. It's going to be very hard to go back and sort of recreate what Stanley Kubrick did so brilliantly. Andy, that is where we must leave it, though, for part one of We Love Movies. But Andy will be back, because in the second half of the show, we'll be reviewing the biopic My Friend Dahmer, which is based on the very early years of the notorious serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer. And Andy's going to be counting down our We Love Movies top 5 serial killer flicks. So we'll be back very shortly.